If you have your Bible, I invite you to turn with me to Acts chapter 22. We're going to start in the last verse, verse 30, and go through chapter 23, verse 22. As you recall, pretty close to the close of Paul's third missionary journey, he leaves at the beginning of it, Ephesus, and makes his way through his loop over and down to Corinth and back up, and kind of because of him getting run out, basically, of Ephesus, he meets with the elders away from Ephesus, encourages them, gives them a word about false teachers and people rising up within the church to cause problems and to try to distort the truth and teach things that were false. He gets warned by several different groups not to go to Jerusalem, that trouble awaits him in Jerusalem. And he has a clear conviction that the Lord wants him to go to Jerusalem. And so he's making his way there. While he's in Jerusalem, the Jews, mostly the religious leaders, come after him. He is more or less rescued by the commander. And remember, they're in the temple area, the outer court of the Temple Mount, the temple area. And a lot of people don't realize this, but in the temple area there was an area that the Romans placed about 200 soldiers there with the commander. They gave the Jews almost 100% free rein when it came to practicing their Judaism and even Christianity. And they only really cared about two things. One is that the taxes got collected and sent to Rome, and that peace was always there, and there wasn't an uprising, and there wasn't the possibility of them trying to overthrow the Roman Empire. Now, they were skeptical about allowing them to continue with the activities inside the temple because of the walls around it and the way it was built. It was too much like a fortress. So they put that Roman soldiers and a commander there, one, to make sure that they didn't start something in planning there to overthrow the Roman rule, and if something got out of hand, that they could intervene. Well, when Paul was there, it did get out of hand. And the commander and the soldiers go down and rescue Paul, basically. And as they're leading Paul out, Paul speaks to the commander. And he speaks in a Hebrew dialect, probably Aramaic. And the commander is like, wow. And he says, yes, I'm not only a Jew, but I'm a Roman. I'm a Roman citizen. And the commander of the Roman soldiers did not want to violate the rights of a Roman citizen. So he brings Paul in protection, and basically he's going to let him go. But when we get to verse 30, and it's an unfortunate break. If you have a paragraph Bible, that means that all the verses run together and they're separated only by paragraphs. Or if you have a verse-by-verse Bible, I use a verse-by-verse Bible in my reading because it's easier for me to pick out the verses as I'm teaching through it. But if you have a verse-by-verse, the paragraphs are identified by either what looks like a backwards P with two lines going down, or also a bold verse number. Like in my Bible that I use, this little Holman, it's got a bold 30, and it's got the backward P with the two lines going down. If you have a Ryrie, it probably just has a bold 30. So that's an unfortunate break. And I can't answer why the translators devised it that way. By the way, it probably ought to go without saying, but I don't want to assume anything. The Greek text was not written with chapters and verses to it. That was added later to help us with referencing items. In fact, the Greek text was written with all capital letters, and there was no spacing in between because of the value of the parchment and the writing instrument. So here he talks about in verse 30, "But on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released," that's he, the commander, "released him," Paul, "and ordered the chief priests and all the councils to assemble. And he brought Paul down and set him before them." Now, verse 1, corresponding with verse 10 of chapter 23 and verse 5, leads me to believe that they had this meeting not where they would have met if it had just been the high priest and the council. They would have met in a smaller chamber. But because the commander wanted to observe and make sure Paul's rights as a Roman citizen didn't get violated, I tend to think that they met in the larger court area of the temple. And I'll show you why I believe that when we get down a little bit later. Verse 1, the commander wants to get to the bottom of it. He wants to find out why they are so adamantly against Paul. And so verse 23, chapter 23, verse 1, Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." Now, Paul doesn't mean that he's not a sinner, but he means that as far as a Hebrew, he's lived by the law. And now that he's a Christian, he's lived by the Spirit. And so he has a clear conscience. No matter what his personality is, no matter what his faults are, his motives have been right. And he has tried to do the right thing. And we know that he went from a persecutor of the church to a promoter of the church. And in Acts chapter 9, had that amazing Damascus Road experience. And he says, "Listen, I've got a clear conscience. I've got a clear conscience." Verse 2, "The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth." Just popped him right in the chops because of what he said. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck?" So Paul says, "Listen, you're accusing me of breaking the law. You just broke the law by having me struck." Now, number one is, Ananias is the high priest. Paul shouldn't have spoken to him that way. So there's the possibility that Paul didn't know that he was the high priest. Now, if they had met in the chamber of a smaller chamber where it would just been the high priest, the council, and Paul is the accused, he would have had on his priestly garments, and he would have been positioned on a seat that would have identified him as the high priest. So one case is Paul didn't realize he was the high priest. I mean, they had changed many high priests since Paul had last been in Jerusalem. So that's a possibility. So Paul comes back at him, and then in verse 4, "But the bystanders said, do not rival God's high priest. And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. For it is written, And there he quotes Exodus chapter 22, verse 28. You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. So there's a possibility that Paul didn't know it, who he was. Verse 6, Paul plays one side against the other. It's kind of like a child. Have you ever, well, you may have done it as a child. You know, you go ask your mom, hey, mom, can I go and stay with so-and-so tonight? Well, no, you can't. Then you go and ask your dad, and your dad says, well, if your mom's okay with it, you know, and then you kind of start figuring out how you can manipulate the two against one another and say, well, dad said I could go. So Paul is going to take the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and he's going to play them against one another. Now, Paul was a Pharisee. And the difference that you all know now, because you remember the Sadducees are Sadducee because they didn't believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees did believe in the resurrection. So Paul is going to stir up. He says, you know, if I can get them fighting against one another, the focus will be off of me. Verse 6, but perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. Now, remember when they first started preaching in Jerusalem about Jesus Christ, remember they came and said, listen, you can preach about Jesus, but you just can't talk about Christ as the Messiah and the resurrection. Well, if you take Christ as the Messiah and the resurrection, you got nothing to preach about. So Paul, it's, I always envision Paul doing this. Throwing the hand grenade in among them, you know, watch them scatter. So he goes right to what he knows is just going to infuriate the Sadducees. Verse 7, and as he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. I mean, can't you just see them just going at it, you know, and having this huge debate? It'd be almost like, you know, going and having a group of egalitarians on one side and complementarians on one side and throwing out whatever side you wanted to have go at each other. And that's what Paul did. He got them really worked up. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge all of them. And there occurred a great uproar. And some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. So it's like he knew what buttons to push. He says, man, if I can just get the Pharisees to understand, I'm not preaching heresy. I'm on their side. I believe in the resurrection. So it doesn't take long for he's got them. I don't find anything wrong with Paul. He believes like I believe. Suppose, we find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And that's just like a jab right to the Pharisees. Says, not only does he believe in the resurrection like we do, you know those angels and spirits you don't believe in? Maybe they're the ones that told him about it. Oh, yeah. In the situation that Paul's in, I think, you know, I don't know that he's having fun, but he's not backing down for sure. In verse 10, he says, and as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So if he gets those people so agitated, maybe in the back of Paul's mind is, you know, this Roman commander, knowing that I'm a Roman citizen, is not going to let anything happen to me. And so they bring him back to the barracks. And then again, Jesus shows up like he did on the Damascus Road to Paul. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his, Paul's, side and said, "Take courage. For as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." What could Paul take away from that? They're not going to kill me here. He probably doesn't understand he's going to get killed in Rome. But he knew and was convinced that God had called him to go back to Jerusalem. And he also was told by God that it was going to be with trouble and persecution. There's not like exactly, but there's a lot of similarity to Christ and his arrest and his trial. A lot of things were violated, and we're going to cover that in the Passion Week study. But you know, Christ was struck also for what he said, and here Christ comes. Take courage, and you know what? Christ is saying, he said to Paul, but he's saying to all of us who believe in Jesus and take a stand for him, when we suffer persecution, he's telling us, take courage. Take courage because you are a witness for the cause of Christ. And if you are a witness for the cause of Christ, you are going to suffer persecution. It may not be being martyred, but it might be being slandered or made fun of, or, you know, your family members thinking, you know, you've gone off the deep end, or whatever. But it's going to come with persecution. So he tells them he's going to go to Rome. And next week, if I can get it together, I'm going to try to have some slides when we get to showing. I've got some great slides from the trip to Israel of Caesarea, the ruins, and that's where Paul is going to leave from and end up going to Rome. They're going to take him to Caesarea from here to keep him safe with a huge cavalry taking him over there. And we'll get to that next week because they're going to plot after this to kill Paul. So verses 12 through 15 is the plot to assassinate Paul. When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. Obviously, they didn't go to Rawls Baptist Church, but you'd have to take a different kind of oath than that, because we eat around here. So in other words, they make a pact with one another. Listen, none of us are going to eat or drink until we get Paul killed. Now, they probably took the Scarii, who were known as Cloak and Dagger Gang, basically, of that day. And Josephus talks about, in his, he's a first century historian, in his, some of his writings, about how the high priest and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, when the Pharisees and the Sadducees weren't fighting against one another and they had the same common enemy, that they would hire the Scarii to go and execute an assassin, put out a hit on somebody. And that's probably what they were going to try to do to Paul. Verse 13, he says, "There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and to the elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul.'" Now, they're not personally going to kill him, but they're going to have him killed. Verse 15, Now, therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. So they tell him to go and say, hey, get the commander to bring Paul back. Tell him we want to, you know, do another investigation, talk to him. And they're setting up to have him killed before he even gets there to the council. So here's a good trivia question if you ever are writing trivia for a Bible class or anything. Did Paul have a nephew? And the answer is yes. So, or did Paul have a sister? And the answer is yes. And did Paul's sister have a son? And the answer is yes. So, verse 16, Paul's nephew relays a message to the commander. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. So he took him and led him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul tomorrow to the council. As though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them. For more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse or an oath not to eat. In other words, if they break it, they would be cursed. Under a curse, not to eat or drink until they have slayed him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. So the commander let the young man go, instructed him, tell no one that you have notified me of these things. So from that, Paul is going to get moved to Caesarea. And Caesarea is right there on the Mediterranean coast, and had a port, and that's where Paul eventually is going to set sail after he has a couple of more encounters, one with Felix and one with Festus, and then one with King Agrippa. And King Agrippa probably, if you read this, probably was going to let Paul go. But he had pleaded to Rome, and therefore he was bound by duty to send him to Rome. And guess who is not surprised about that? Paul. You know, if Jesus appears to you, which he's not today, but if he does, and he tells you something's going to happen, and you're going to go somewhere, guess what? Something's going to happen, and you're going to go somewhere. Because it's going to happen. So Paul is not going to be shot when he's sent to Rome, where he shouldn't have been shot anyway. But I'll try to get those slides and we'll look at them. Because, I stood right there in the praetorium, Herod's praetorium, right where Paul, on the platform that's still there, the remains, where Paul would have given his defense before King Agrippa. And standing there, you know, and having studied the way I've studied, and having Charlie there, and he and I having conversations, I remember just pausing and thinking to myself, the Apostle Paul stood right here. Not like, you know, you go to the Sermon on the Mount, and they go, well, the Sermon on the Mount took place somewhere in this area, you know, and they've got a place that they, you know, have tourized up. And then you go to other places, but when you're in the Garden of Gethsemane, you can go, you know, Jesus was right here. You know, I mean, it's pretty well, it's more than that. It's hard to put into words what it is, but it's just like, yeah. Any questions about what we've covered? All right. Well, the 40 weren't concerned about that. That's why I think Josephus is right that they had probably hired some assassins. Well, but the Roman guard, I mean, if they hadn't reported it, they didn't know it got reported. They weren't going to take a whole cavalry to take him like they were art to Caesarea. They were just going to bring him down like they did. I mean, I don't think, you know. I mean, you could be right, but, right. Yeah. Well, and there's also the sense that, you know, when you are enraged, you don't make good rational decisions. You know, anger and bitterness and can sometimes get your brain in a big fog. So, all right. Well, thanks for coming, and we'll see you Sunday. Deo Volante and Marty, good to see you here. Thanks for coming.